At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Hello, everyone. We have liftoff. Welcome back to a brand new episode of the Silver Screen podcast. I am your regular host, Mike Wilson. And this week, if you've been keeping up with our socials and our schedule, you'll know that we are discussing the movie First Man. But we are not alone. I am, of course, joined as always by my co-host, DK.
Hello.
And we are joined by a very special first-time guest here, someone who specifically requested when I mentioned this movie to come on this episode, so I'm guessing she might be a fan. Sandra Evanson, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, thank you.
And you're calling us from somewhere in, I'm guessing, America, judging by the accent?
Texas, yes.
Texas, wow. Awesome. So you have a very special connection, I'm guessing, to like the Apollo 11 mission and the space program.
I do like space, yes.
Nice.
Where about from Texas are you from, Sandra?
San Antonio. So the south central southern part, yeah.
Nice.
It's just my wife from Texas.
Ah, I didn't know that. You'd think I would know that by now, but nope. Fair enough. So, yeah, so as I said, there's no real reason for this. It was just a film that I decided to try to put in because it's a film I wanted to talk about, and I thought there'd be a lot to talk about, but I suppose for argument's sake, we could still claim, despite doing the Toy Story 2 review last week, that this kind of feeds into Lightyear, which is still going to be in cinemas at the moment. But yeah, it's a tenuous link at best, I suppose. But yeah, I'm looking forward to talking about the movie with everyone. But as you know, if you are a regular listener, before we get into all of that, we start with the behind-the-scenes section. And for that, I throw it over to TK to take the reins.
Okay, thank you, Mike. Okay, now the movie is based on the book First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong by James R. Hansen, which was first published in 2005. To date, it's the only official biography of Armstrong. Film rights to the book were sold in 2003 before it was even published, with Clint Eastwood initially pegged to direct, but eventually those duties fell to Damien Chazelle, who also directed Gosling in La La Land. Now, according to Chazelle, Gosling was the first and only one he had in mind for the role. Now, Chazelle thought that the best way to shoot the moon sequences was to shoot at night while simulating the sun with a giant film light. The light used to create the effect in this film is the biggest one ever used, and was created especially for the production. Now, the opening scene of the movie, in which Armstrong's X-15 struggles to re-enter its atmosphere after hitting the stratosphere, was accurate. Armstrong really did go through the events depicted in the movie as his fighter kept bouncing off the Earth's atmosphere. Now, Chazelle was determined to make the film as authentic as possible. To this end, he instructed chief designer Nathan Crawley that no ship was to be enlarged more than 10% for filming, regardless of the comfort of the actors. However, even with the small amount of extra space, it still wasn't enough for framing. The solution was to have the capsule come in detachable segments in order to accommodate cameras. Now, during the Apollo 11 landing sequence, the Capcom communications were not recorded by actors for the movie. They were the actual historic recordings of astronaut Charlie Duke taken from Mission Control during the moon landing. Mark and Rick Armstrong state the movie is the most accurate depiction of their father and mother they've ever seen on screen. Okay, now the omission of one event caused a backlash upon the film's release. The scene where Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin plant the US flag on the lunar surface was omitted from the movie and was deemed anti-American by some, despite this decision being backed up by Armstrong's sons. Now, international figure of ridicule and professional loser Donald Judas Trump was quoted as saying, "It's almost like they're embarrassed at the achievements coming from America." So close, Donnie, so close. I guarantee they were embarrassed at the achievements coming from America. Now, Gosling fired back at the culture war incitement, claiming that Armstrong was a humble man, and the achievement was widely regarded as a human achievement rather than that of any sole country. And they wanted the film to reflect that. Now, while Josh Singer, the screenwriter, wished to show parts of the story that people weren't necessarily familiar with instead of the usual elements from that landing. As part of this, towards the end, Armstrong wanders off on his own and throws his daughter Karen's bracelet into the crater. This has caused some argument among historians, and it's not exactly accurate. Though Armstrong did take some time out away from Aldrin, there's no evidence to suggest that of to what he did there. Several scholars believe that this is what happened. Certainly Josh Singer's research suggests that he did, though when asked while he was still alive, Armstrong himself denied it, but then was unable to provide the manifest list of what he took in his PPK, leading some to speculate. Armstrong was obviously a very private man, so would he admit that if true? I guess we'll never know until we broadcast our third podcast from the moon. Let's hope it's less riddled with technical issues than our podcast at the moment.
Yeah. We can land a man on the moon, but we apparently can't communicate with Spain without some difficulty. Fair enough. No, I remember, now that you mentioned that whole rigmarole and palaver, I do remember that kind of coming up and becoming a political thing, as did basically everything around that time. But it really didn't strike me as being a deliberate omission, other than the fact that it's not about, the movie is not about the mission, it's about the man. So it wouldn't have made a lot of sense to, like, it was following Neil rather than the mission itself. So that's why I personally didn't miss that scene, I guess.
No.
And they did take great pains to kind of show everybody's reaction around the world, how they felt about it in France, and how much faith they had in America that they were going to make this happen.
Definitely. And I mean, it is ultimately, NASA is an American organization, and it did take the time to show the cost of it, you know what I mean, on everyone as well. And and you know what, they didn't have to show the JFK speech at the end, which was the instigating factor for it. But yeah, fascinating to give it that historical perspective, which I appreciated as well. So
And because there were conversations about, is this space race, is it worth the cost, both monetarily and what we weren't able to do for people at home, simultaneously fighting the Vietnam War, and then of course the loss of life. You know, and JFK's speech kind of brought that all home, you know, that it is worth it.
Yeah. Definitely. And it's one of the things I appreciated, not to jump too far ahead, but it didn't really, for some reason, it just never really occurred to me, like, to put it into context, that the scenes of the black people protesting about saying, you know, we are essentially living in slums and we're not getting government support and everything, but meanwhile white guys are
on the moon.
You know? Yeah. Whitey's on the moon, essentially, yeah. So I was like, wow, it never even crossed my mind, which is, I guess, white privilege in action, I suppose.
But there's a lot in this movie that I mean, we look back on the events now as a given, as it just happened, as if it was just going down to the shops. But it's not until you watch something like that you see how much work and how much sacrifice was put into this program.
Yeah, and I'm much like, from conversations I've had, much like Sandra, I'm kind of fascinated by just NASA and space and the effort that it takes in general. So I'm always kind of in awe and aware of, like, yeah, it's not an easy thing, and it does take a lot of, sadly, loss of life, do you know what I mean, to get you there. Definitely. Amongst other things. But then the sheer endurance and the physicality, like, I, when I was younger, I think I was always like, I want to be an astronaut, and then I saw what they go through, and I was like, F that.
Yeah, I was exactly the same. I mean, I still follow NASA. I have, you know, I've signed up for their emails, and I watch every launch.
And I
think it's a real shame that the fervor around these kind of things have died down. Everyone kind of takes it for granted now, and it's, when you watch it, it still hits home just how much people are putting into this.
Definitely. But bringing it back to the film, though, I think it was an interesting angle and a fascinating thing to look at the actual man and to show his life and that kind of big, you know, the humanity achievement in the context of the one person who did it and what it meant in context to his life. So, it was,
because Apollo 11 certainly been done before.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I've seen documentaries about Apollo 11 and what it would have taken to get there, and the actual like I said, more of a documentary than the docudrama, I guess, that this is. And yeah, I kind of had my suspicions that parts of it were probably embellished, exaggerated, or just pure made up, including that sort of powerful scene at the end. I didn't really expect that it would necessarily be realistic, but it made sense in terms of what the story the film was trying to tell. In that, I assume that, you know, Neil Armstrong had lost a daughter and it would have affected him. So, you know, to that end, at least it's true, even if the actual literal act isn't. So, yeah, I can forgive it for that. A little bit of a creative license, I guess, if need be. Excuse me. Yeah, so did you have any other behind-the-scenes facts or anything for us, DK?
No, that was everything.
Awesome, awesome. Well, so just before we jump into the sort of sections and start talking about the movie properly, then I always like to ask just a sort of bit of background as to how you came to this movie. And I'm fascinated to learn it for, well, I know yours, DK, but I'll get to it. But I'm fascinated to learn from you, Sandra. What was it that led you to the film First Man? Did you see it in cinemas? And what was your experience of watching it for the first time?
I didn't see it in cinema. And for some reason, I didn't hear about it right when it came out. I think it just must have been a busy time for me. But I think after I had watched on Apple TV For All Mankind, and then I started searching out something, like I couldn't get enough. And I started searching out films like this and I came across it. And I don't know why I skipped over it before, because it's certainly something I'm very fascinated with. And then, you know, I did watch it and I liked it. It was very understated. I mean, it's not Gravity. It's not Interstellar. You know, it's very much grounded in realism. And the fact that they took, I was very, very excited with how important it was them to be real, to be, to have this grounded in realism. And that's what really interested me, because I felt I could learn from this movie, learn things maybe I didn't know about before. And I was interested to find out that they actually, there's some unseen footage here that the film crew actually recovered and restored for this film.
Oh, wow. Didn't know that. That's awesome. Yeah. That's cool. Yeah. Anything we can find that's like part of history always fascinates me. That's why I like these biopics that are actually about events that could affect us, that are within our lifetime, I guess. Not really a fan of biopics if it's, you know, hundreds of years ago talking about Tudors or old kings and queens, because it doesn't affect us. But I have tons of various films about like the Watergate scandal and stuff, for example, because I was like, that's not that far removed from when I was born. But yeah, and so obviously, like, being a space nut, this would have interested me anyway. So I'll get into the story of what my experience was with the film for the first time. But DK, your first experience is purely because of the podcast, correct?
It is, yes. I mean, I'll be completely honest with you. Other than Drive, I've never been a big fan of Ryan Gosling. Mm. And so when I saw this, although I was interested by the subject matter, the actor didn't really excite me enough to want to watch it. So it kind of came and it went, and it, you know, it just flew by my radar. And it wasn't until you said that it was coming up that I thought, better get my ass in gear and get this watched.
Fair enough. And I haven't spoken to you about the film, because this is like the first time, and I'm genuinely fascinated to discover with you what your kind of opinion of the film is and what you thought of it. Because, like I said, we tend to know because it's a film that you've seen in advance, and this is one that you watch specifically for the podcast. So that's going to be a fascinating angle as well.
Yeah.
Cool. I actually am the only one of us here then that did go to the cinema to see the movie, which is odd, because I'm not really a fan of Ryan Gosling myself either. And I hadn't actually watched La La Land or any of Damien Chazelle's stuff. It was just that I knew it was about the Apollo 11 mission and space, and it fascinated me. And I will say that the overriding experience of going to see this in the cinema was the scene relatively early on when the capsule's out of control and it starts spinning and the Earth kind of just appears on like a roller coaster type thing, just whipping past the window. That made me violently sick in the cinema, because it was incredibly realistic on a massive like screen being projected for you. And I did actually have to step out for like 2 minutes after that scene and just gather my bearings and be like, whoa, that was a little bit too real. I can't imagine what that must have been like to actually experience from within the capsule or whatever, because oh. And then I did rewatch the Blu-ray, which I have for this podcast. And thankfully, when you're watching it on a smaller screen, it doesn't have that kind of effect. It didn't make me ill. So I was like, all right, fair enough. but yeah, I was waiting on that moment coming because I was like, oh, it's going to be rough again. But no, as I say, kudos to anybody who puts up with that and can not pass out, because I was virtually there just watching. I think I was the only person. I didn't go with anybody to watch the film. I just kind of went on my own, as I sometimes do, because I thought I was fascinated and I wanted to see it. So, and we'll get into my thoughts and opinions as we discuss more and more of it. So, we kind of break the podcast down loosely into categories, as you know. So it's like acting, writing, direction, music, scenes, etc. But we can obviously, you know, within that talk about various things and go off on tangents if need be. But just for the sake of kind of keeping to within some kind of structure, the first thing that we would talk about would normally be the acting, which it makes sense, I guess, to talk about the man we've brought up a couple of times now, Ryan Gosling. And I'm going to ask you, Sandra, what your thoughts were, first of all, about Gosling in the lead role of this film. And what did you think of his performance?
I was impressed with his performance. I am a Ryan Gosling fan, although not, okay. I also haven't seen La La Land. Right. But I mean, the entire film is understated, so to speak, mm-hmm. because they are playing real people. These aren't dramatic people. These are average Americans. I think the biggest really acting scene for him is the opening scene where, you know, of course, you know, we see that his daughter's ill, and really this is where the film lays out, you know, the man himself, what this is about. And, you know, we show how it shows how he's like got to be in control. He just kind of has this intensity about how can his daughter, you know, how can he solve his daughter's problem? But then she does pass away. And then there after the funeral at the home, and he goes into a room, closes the drapes where he can be alone, and he's just overcome with this profound sadness. And you feel that. He does convey that very well. And in all other places, I feel like the direction of his acting was poker face. We need poker face from you, Ryan, because he's just very into the moment. He's got control, but he doesn't show a lot of emotion outside of his family, maybe a few moments there. But in that way, you know, that he does need to be understated, that he does need to be realistic, but he's still able to pull out these little performances when it does call for that emotion. You know, I was impressed with that.
Awesome. Yeah, it's strange you say it. Weirdly enough, the kind of one word that I've got written down and underlined is the same exact thing that you brought up multiple times, and it is that I said it was understated as a performance, because for an actor, it kind of, for me, wasn't. It was deliberately not showy, and kind of like, we're going for the Oscar and we're going to wring every kind of emotion out of this scene. And from what I've seen in footage and stuff, it strikes me that that probably was the kind of person that Neil Armstrong was, you know, very bottled up, keep his emotions to himself, private kind of person. So that seemed to have a bit of realism to it. But I did appreciate that when we got towards the end of the film and Gosling had to deliver, you know, the historic lines, that's got to be quite daunting. And I appreciated that he at least put the necessary kind of gravitas and gave the weight and time to those lines rather than treating it as throwaway, which I know could have been a choice that a lot of actors would have made so as to not look intimidated by them. But yeah, I appreciate that. And I appreciated it even when, you know, when Armstrong was being callous or isolating himself, I think that there was a vulnerability that I picked up from Gosling's performance that a lesser actor wouldn't necessarily have, because there was times when it was hard to like him in the way he was acting, and yet you still felt, I think, a little bit of sympathy or empathy for him. And again, that's a very subtle way of portraying that from somebody who doesn't give you a lot.
So, I know the part you're talking about. It's when right before he's going up on Apollo and he's really ignoring his family.
Yeah,
he's
packing.
He doesn't, you know, she wants to say, you know, you might not be coming back. You need to address this with your children. And he's not wanting to entertain that idea at all. But then he does. He goes, he sits down in front of his son, who's just got this piercing look. And he's... though his face doesn't betray it, he's wringing his hands, he's rubbing his hands. And in that moment, he does look vulnerable.
Yeah, 100%. That wasn't actually the scene I was thinking of, but I don't disagree with you. That's absolutely true.
It's the scene that I thought you were referring to be honest.
No, the scene I'm referring to is kind of, and it made me almost rage about the kind of lack of empathy from the character, that he didn't realize the effect of what he does on other people in the same kind of way. It was when he's doing the kind of, it's after we've had that horrible accident and we've lost some of the astronauts, and he's doing the kind of tests on the planes, and he has to basically bail out and then arrives back home kind of battered, bruised and dirty, goes for a glass of water, and his wife is understandably like, what the heck happened, what's going on? And he just goes, oh, I forgot something at the office, because he can't deal with the emotion of it, and just turns around and walks back out. And I was like,
all right,
that is just out of order, really. And yet I accept it. I understand where he's coming from. It was completely overwhelming for him at that moment. You know, there's a thousand things to consider of he's lost his friends, he could have been lost himself, and now he's got to kind of come home, and there's no decompressing from that. It's just straight into what the heck happened. And I think it was, I appreciated the reality of that moment, even though, like I said, if it was me who was in that position as his wife, I very much would have been extremely pissed off with him, frankly. But so what were your thoughts on Gosling's performance then, DK?
He really impressed me. It was a very, as you both mentioned, it was a very understated performance, and it's not something that I would have expected from Gosling from the limited experience I've had with him. It did draw attention to the fact that Armstrong is supposedly this very private, very humble person, and he was in situations, he didn't probably play it the best as a person when it came to his family and things like that, but you never disliked the character from him. You could always see the angle that he was coming from, just because of the amount of pressure that he was under. I mean, it brought across that he was forever haunted by the death of his daughter. Unfortunately, with the line of work he was in, death, you know, was a major risk, and losing so many around him, it obviously would have had an effect. And I think that caused him more and more to focus on his work as time went on. And it seems as though interpersonal relationships suffered the more he focused. He did come across as very driven, not to the point where he would cast other people aside deliberately, but his other relationships did kind of suffer as a result. And I think that you thought it was a fascinating portrayal.
Definitely. I hope this doesn't come across massively controversial, but as somebody who, and I've mentioned this a few times, who was recently kind of diagnosed as being on the autistic spectrum, the performance reminded me a lot of somebody who might have had like undiagnosed autism, because he's very, he struggles with emotion and understanding social aspects and things and the effect that his actions have on other people emotionally. But he is very obsessive and perfectionist when it comes to his work. He just doesn't understand that can mean, you know, other people might not see him again or anything. And that's why I appreciated the movie actually taking the time to have those scenes of like, no, discuss it with your kid, and actually having, you know, out of the mouth of babes, having the son say, is there a chance you might not come back? Can you promise me you'll come back? Or is that, you know, no matter how slim or whatever, is there a chance we'll never see you again? And I just really appreciate
that.
That's
interesting. I can see that. Yeah.
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 I mean, it falls back into that scene where he's in the garden, where he leaves the party early, and he's in the garden, and Ed comes up to him, and you know, Ed tries to coax it out of him, and he turns around and says, Ed, if I really wanted to speak to somebody, would I be here in my garden?
100%. Yeah, absolutely. And like I said, it's because even when it seems like it could be, it's never like he's being callous or he doesn't care. I think it just literally didn't occur to him almost. Yeah. Like I said, the key moment being like, your kids could lose you forever. And it just hadn't really even crossed his mind until he was presented with it, and it hit him, I guess, like a train in a way. And it was like, oh, right, well, now I can't focus on anything other than packing and getting on with the mission, because it's just overwhelming, I guess. So,
I think that angle on the opposite side of the things, the absolute hell that the wives and the families had to go through while waiting.
Yes, definitely, definitely. And I mean, again, it's something you don't really consider, but, and again, I can't remember, I should have looked up the name of the actress, but the actress who kind of plays the widow of the guy who gets lost in the horrible fire, who's kind of, she's the bubbly kind of, oh, I'll show you how to navigate this world and everything, and then just gets completely broken by his loss. And then, just in the most subtle of scenes, when she's when Claire Foy's kind of walking over to her, and she's got nothing left. I was like, that is heartbreaking. And it's one of those best kind of examples of a very small scene that doesn't, you know, it doesn't insist on itself, and it doesn't loudly, flashily have somebody railing against the unfairness of everything. It's just that it brings home the reality of this to the people that you wouldn't necessarily think about. And
normally in these kind of things, you just concentrate on the right stuff angle, the guys in the cockpit. You never see that much or how it affects the family. And I did like the approach on this one.
And I think that contributed to making you feel even more tense for Neil's wife, because you did feel like, look, she now can see, you know, there, but for the grace of God goes me, and that could be me, and I don't know if I would be able to cope with it at all. And yeah, it's nerve-wracking, it is. But on a similar note, like going back to the acting and stuff, I was trying to look for kind of, because there's a really good supporting cast of kind of well-known, famous and character actors, and I was looking for little moments where they might stand out, and there's not really anything hugely, again, showy or standout, even though there's some solid performances. But there is one line, and it's from Kyle Chandler, actually, and it's at the very, well, toward the end when they're about to go up on the mission, and they're reading out basically the prepared statement for what would have happened if they had to be left on the moon and everything. And it's literally two words. Kyle Chandler just says, "Sounds fine," but he says it with such venom and such that I was like, that is such a really great performance of that, because again, you could play that a thousand different ways, and the way that he plays it is like, I resent that we have to do this and have to be prepared like this, but I understand it. I just don't like it, I guess.
Yeah.
So,
I was just going to call out Olivia, the actress's name. Hamilton, yeah.
Okay. Oh, okay. Awesome.
Oh, nice. Pat.
Pat, that's
she
it.
Was also in La La Land, which we didn't see.
I will have to watch that at some time. I really will. I quite like musicals as well. There's no excuse, but never mind.
Someone who I wish we could have seen more of, but I mean, you know, he just didn't have a place in the movie, was Pablo Schreiber. I just love him. And he had a few small scenes. But again, like you said, nothing that really stands out.
Yeah. I mean, I noted a few names. Like I said, Jason Clarke, I thought was quite good. Shea Whigham was good in a very, very brief couple of appearances. And obviously you have Corey Stoll as Buzz Aldrin, who I think
I think that threw me a little. This is going to betray my absolute knowledge of cinema. But as soon as I saw him, my first thought, and this is reflects badly on me, is don't trust him. He's a villain simply because of Ant-Man.
Yeah, I was like, that's the yellow jacket.
Yeah,
immediately I don't like him.
I never knew it before, but they seem to have such very different personalities that Aldrin seemed more outgoing with a tendency to call things as he saw it, whereas Armstrong was more an introverted type.
Well, so, you don't get the name Buzz because you're a quiet, retiring wallflower, do you really?
No, but it didn't. I'd never really picked up on that dynamic between them until this movie.
Yeah.
I did actually literally Google, was Buzz Aldrin a jerk? Because of how they portrayed him in this. And, you know, they said that they did get along with him. They wouldn't have all been on the same mission if they didn't. But that he wasn't a jerk. He just did. He just said what he thought. And that's, we'll bring that up later as one of my favorite lines. So
awesome.
Going back to the acting, I did love the way that Corey Stroll was giving Gosling the side eye as they were going over the lunar surface, as if to say, does this guy know what he's doing?
Yeah, I think I also read it as a tiny bit of resentment of like, yeah, you're getting to go first. And yeah, he was the kind landing. Of competitive, you know, person that was like, I kind of wished it was my shot, because he does say that kind of, and again, it could be portrayed as callous, but I think it's more just that he's competitive like that when he's, you know, why not? There's a spot open. I could have the shot to do that and become the first guy on the moon. And as you say, to have gone all of that way and then be told, you'll be second man on the moon. There's got to be a degree of like, oh, dang, that was so close.
Did they get on in real life?
As far as I know, I mean, I've seen interviews and stuff, but I've never actually, sat down with the people. I'm assuming none of us have met like any of the astronauts or anything like that. But no, I have watched interviews and stuff with Buzz Aldrin, and he is like a really sound, like nice-seeming guy. Very proud of the actual moon mission. does not take crap from people that are like, well, what do you say to these people that are like, it could have been filmed by Kubrick and the spots don't match up and whatever, to the point that I'm pretty sure he's actually punched a guy out for claiming this.
He does not suffer fools badly.
Yeah, definitely not. But the last kind of thing I wanted to talk about, unless there's anything that comes up in the acting, is Claire Foy, who seems to have gotten a weirdly mixed reception from what I've seen in this film. I think, personally, just to get my thoughts out of the way, that she has quite a thankless role, because she kind of... most of what she's doing is just being worried about the lead character. And I think during a lot of the more emotional scenes, it does kind of show that, for me, she's a little bit out of her depth. But she is great when she actually has the chance to go for it and like rail against NASA or against Neil, and she actually gets to express that emotion. But like I see, a lot of the time it just seemed like TV actress trying her best for me.
I don't know. I think she had a good accent, which is more than you can say for some in there, I think. Kieran Hines. But I think she did it really well, especially on that scene where they turn the box off. And she ends up going straight down to Capcom and just letting rip.
That's my favorite scene. That's what I mean. Like, even though I do kind of, I don't want to say like I don't rate her performance such, but there are key moments that I really did like, and that was one of them, where she kind of goes and she's telling them to turn the box on, and then, as I said, kind of alluded to earlier, the scenes when she kind of makes Neil sit down and talk to the kids about things. But I did note that there's a few scenes where it ventures into cliche, which didn't really work. And one of them was when she has this whole scene about, I wanted stability, which I was like, oof, this is playing it a little bit too daytime Emmy for me.
I think, unfortunately, when you go and see a film like this, you are going to see it for one aspect only. And that is the person at the center of the narrative.
Yeah.
Now, obviously it's dwelling on the family side of things, and I do respect that, but Janet's always got... Is it Janet? Or am I
Janet. Yes.
Yeah, she's always going to be a kind of second fiddle to most of the movie-going audience. And I do respect the fact that Chazelle and Singer and Foy imbued the character with as much as they possibly could to make her interesting when you compare it to pretty much what is a legend, a modern-day legend.
Yeah, definitely. I see what you mean. I think that there was potentially a better actress they may have been able to cast in the role. But again, I feel mean saying that because it's just, you know, it's not that Claire Foy gave a bad performance. It's just that there were times when, like I said, she seemed quite out of her depth given the material that was presented. And perhaps just because, even though I'm not a fan of his, Ryan Gosling so impressed me whenever they were kind of together on screen. But again, as I say, I think that's because she had the thankless task of she had to portray all of the emotion of the scene for both of them, because his point and his entire direction was probably to be as stoic as possible. I felt for Claire Foy in a lot of ways, because like I said, it was the hardest job. And for me, it was about 50% accomplished. But did you have any thoughts on Claire Foy's performance, Sandra?
Well, one thing I was worried about when I saw it was that I was only going to see the queen, because that's just the worst thing. You see a movie and all you see is people from other roles. But I thought that in some scenes she had a very naturalness about her. But in other scenes, I am picking up what you're saying, where she just felt unnatural in the scene. And it brings you out of the movie for a second. So I do know what you mean. However, as far as like her, how she held herself, and did she look like, you know, a mid-60s housewife supporting her husband? I felt like she did do well in those respects. And then, like you said, there was just a few scenes where she was able to kind of break out and show some emotion. And those are the scenes where she stood out a little bit. But some awkward moments, I guess, is how I would phrase it.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was trying to say, without trying to sound incredibly sexist. I think there was just a little bit of awkwardness, to a couple of the scenes, a little bit stilted. But, I have to ask this then, as an American, what did you think of Claire Foy's American accent? Because you probably would have picked up on things you couldn't.
I thought it was fine.
That's fair enough. I keep forgetting, of course, at times that these English actors putting on American accents probably sound fine to us, and then you speak to an American and they're like, oh no, because I know the reverse is very true when an American puts on a British accent.
I was just gonna say that.
It's very hit or miss. Don't anybody listen to Dick Van Dyke attempt an English accent, because we don't sound anything like that. But
so no Mary Poppins, got it.
Anyway, That's neither here nor there. So did you guys have any last thoughts on the acting before I move to kind of the next part of the review?
Not particularly, nope.
Fair enough. So the next thing I want to talk about is just anything that might fit into the writing and any thoughts you guys had on that. The first thing that I noticed is that, again, this was the second watch that I noticed it, that it actually points out the multi-axis trainer that you have to go through. The first thing that I saw where I was like, nope, not going to be an astronaut ever. So I kind of appreciated that they showed that, but I'd seen it so many times that I didn't realize until second viewing that it's kind of setting it up Chekhov's gun style, that Armstrong has to go through that so that when they actually get to the part that did make me sick, when it's like the capsule's out of control and spinning wildly, he's able to not pass out and get full control back of it. And I was like, oh, that's actually really economical storytelling, and the kind of it's some nice like show don't tell type stuff, because it didn't occur to me that that scene was there to set up something later. I just thought it was part of the training. So I
actually have show don't tell written down. They did that a lot.
Yes, yeah. Definitely.
It's great writing, definitely, in my opinion.
Definitely. And related to that, I think there's an overriding sense to me that the movie has like the constant specter of death hanging over it. And yet exactly. it never feels maudlin or nihilistic about it. And it never points it out to you like, oh, this, you could die, or there's been death or whatever. Except in one really powerful moment, which I'm sure I'll mention later. But yet it's always there. And I think that's great filmmaking that you can have it in the background without having to think the audience might not realize this and we have to spell it out to them.
I think Armstrong is going to survive all this, but even so, the writing together with the direction, you're on the edge of your seat as if you're not expecting him to survive, both with the X-15 flight at the beginning, the docking with the Adena, and then later on with the lunar landing. You forget you're watching actual events and you become fully drawn into the moment.
Definitely. It's nerve-wracking, or at least I found it nerve-wracking to watch.
Definitely, yeah.
Awesome. I also appreciated this, again, just from a screenwriting perspective, that there's a kind of constant ticking clock that you don't even realize is there because it's kind of off screen, but it sets it up at the very beginning with the Russians beating the Americans to getting the first person in space. And then the idea, again, a lesser filmmaker would have had news reports cutting in every 20 minutes to point out their progress and we have to beat them. But we just got that one thing about, wow, they're going to try and beat us to everything. We have to step up our game. And you know that's there, and you know that that's part of the tension, but it's never spelled out beyond that one scene. And again, I appreciated that it trusts the audience to know, like, well, why are the Americans pushing this, and why is this loss of life necessary? And
they do wrap it up a little later with that scene where they get called in around the TV, and it's showing that you know the Soviets have done the first spacewalk and they've beaten the US.
That's what I mean. Yeah, that's actually quite early on. You probably don't register it as being, but it's quite early on where it's like they've established that we've had the big speech and they're going to try and do the whole landing a man on the moon, and then they get incredibly frustrated because the Soviets have actually got someone into space first. And then there is one brief thing, similar scene when they're at NASA and talking about like the safety protocols and how they're not safe to do something or other. And I think somebody just in the background says, if we don't do it, then the Soviets will beat us to this as well, or something like that. So again, it gives you that sense of tension, and it gives you a little bit of justification, not necessarily morally, but certainly justification as to why the people are doing this and what the, like I said, the ticking clock in the background of it all is.
As I say, when you look back on it now, it's a done deal that, you know, they were always going to succeed, but the film emphasizes just how much of a risk these missions were. I mean, at several points throughout, it puts the audience in the point of view of the astronauts, and you come away realizing just how flimsy these setups, although at the time they were the higher technology, were.
Definitely. And that was the next note that I had, was that I appreciated the writing deciding to show you the macro to the micro, as I've put it, so that you have all of this stuff and all this technology and all these safety protocols, and it focuses on a dodgy seatbelt and the fact that there's a fly in the capsule. And I was like, this, the tiniest thing could spell disaster. And again, it's showing you that without spelling it out to you, without having a character be like, hey, if the slightest thing goes wrong, this could be. And it's just like, it's Neil watching the fly is kind of like, crap, what does this mean? What could happen? And like I said, the seatbelt not quite working, and then thinking to yourself as a viewer, oh, what's going to happen here? What's going on? Even though, like you said, you know what happened, but still.
And he's driven home later in the wiring problem with the oxygen in the capsule that, you know, unfortunately takes the three astronauts.
Definitely. Although even there is one point where the film does kind of tell and not show, but I think it works because it's in context, which is when they have the really harsh press conference, which just points out literally every one of their worst fears to them. And I think you get the sense, again, from the performance, that this is things that Neil hadn't considered, and hearing this is not a comfortable thing for him, I guess. And it calls back to when he was at the funeral and he just didn't want to talk about death or anything like that. So he just doesn't want to address the negative side of things, because for him it's either succeed or there's no other side of things, you know? Yeah.
Another thing I thought it was interesting is I feel like they really showed, particularly after the Gemini 8 mission, when they came back and... it's kind of like we hear about, you know, men being at war and coming home, you know, when you're a part of something so big, how hard it is to come home and just be normal. I think that's when one of the wives was saying, you know, Ed walked around like a zombie when he got back. And the wives just sitting and talking about that, and that they have each other to talk about that. But then the men, when they were together, you know, all they wanted to do was be together and sit around, talk about it. Even though they're back on Earth, they've never actually left space. And they couldn't just go back and be normal. I mean, of course, they did go back. They interacted with their kids. They went about their lives. But they just would never like be normal again. Yeah.
I mean, going back to the writing, it's possible that Armstrong's perspective, and I think they were trying to hammer that home, began to change from the very moment he reached the stratosphere right at the start of the movie, and he saw the Earth from that new perspective. And it's something he touches upon later on several times in the movie. And I think it's possible that that intensified his own kind of withdrawal from events.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of hard to, it's not really a shared experience you can discuss with anybody, I would imagine. You know, it's going to change you, isn't it? Seeing, like you said, the Earth from that kind of perspective. So, I can kind of appreciate that as well, for sure, without it having to spell that out for you. But I did appreciate on the kind of flip side of that we did at least get that scene of, it's a montage towards the end of actually showing that, in spite of everything, Neil and his wife were great parents, and they do kind of just play hide and seek with the kids and have like a good time. Because I think we needed that to emphasize that they weren't cold and distant and ignored their other kids and stuff. So it's only a 2 or 3 minute scene, but again, I just really appreciated that the film took the time to have that in there to show that, you know, that there's a human being at the center of all this at the end of the day. And I was curious what you guys thought about that scene, or if you thought it was a scene that you could have like lived without and you maybe didn't need in the movie.
I think it was important to contain it, because if you are going to have a side where you do show the family life, you're going to have to show every aspect, but you can't have it just beyond the turmoil of this family. You have, obviously, they stuck together. So obviously, you know, you're going to have to show that they did have the good times as well as the bad that they were going through throughout this entire process. And I think it was a good scene to include.
Definitely. Yeah, I think so too. Because if you didn't show it, we might make an incorrect assumption that he withdrew from family life after that. Yes. And that just wasn't the case.
Exactly. Yeah,
that was my point. Yeah, definitely. 100%. So did you guys have any last thoughts on writing before I start talking about the direction and just praise everything for a long time?
No more there. I mean, really, writing kind of leads into direction, kind of leads into... Yeah. I mean, it's sum of its parts, but in this movie, because everything's so understated, especially so.
Definitely.
Yeah. I will say that I do think you think you know everything, but past the usual moments, obviously, you know, the eagle has landed one small step. Mm. You don't really, when you look into it, know that much about Armstrong as a person. He obviously, as I say, worked incredibly hard to get where he was, even when circumstances didn't present themselves. And I think it's a testament to the writing that they actually showed that side of things. So when you did actually get to the eagle has landed, you felt like you knew so much more about him as a person.
Definitely. And that relates to why I, despite the fact that it might not be real, I really loved that touch of the cool, dropping Karen's bracelet onto the lunar surface. Because for me, it is, like I said, it brings it full circle. It re-emphasizes that this is a film about the man, not what the achievement means for mankind, which is still there because it's part of it. But this isn't that story about the historical impact on everyone. It's about the nature of the man, what his life was like getting there, and then the effect that it had on him. Leading up to it and then actually taking part in it. So
Yeah, and when his own sons say this is the most accurate depiction of our parents ever put on screen, you know they've hit the nail on the head, and I do appreciate that.
Definitely, and you get the sense, as I said, from scenes like that, that despite all appearances to the contrary, that Neil was a man who felt very deeply. He just didn't really feel comfortable or feel at ease expressing that, but it was very definitely there. So as I say, I think that having that powerful of a moment physically at the end of the movie just it brings a tear to the eye, really. But yeah,
and the reason they chose him, he wasn't a workhorse like Elliot who got bumped. He was a thinking man, which was illustrated when, you know, they were trying to look for the target vehicle. They're doing their docking. And they're off and they're talking about, you know, getting back on track, and they're asking for a status update. He's like, not right now, I'm busy. And he himself, you know, calculates what's needed right there, pen and paper, no computer. What's needed to correct their trajectory and where he thinks that might be.
Yeah. And I think related to that, I think I got the impression from scenes like that, that this perceived lack of emotion is actually also a lack of panic, which kind of makes him perfect for a mission as dangerous as that.
Exactly. I don't know about you, but if I were in that situation, I would have just lost it.
Yeah, precisely. Like I said, you don't want somebody who's over emotional. That's like, oh God, what are we gonna do? You want somebody that's like, shut up, I'm focusing, I'm gonna get us out of this. I appreciated it a lot.
During the astronaut selection for Project Gemini, and then they were pushing him on that subject. They were asking him, I'm sorry to hear about your daughter. And he's like, was that a question? He's like, well, you know, surely that has to affect you. And just very calmly says, well, of course it affects me, you know, next.
Yeah. Again, I love the way that was written, because it's something like, I think it would be disingenuous to claim that it wouldn't have an effect or something along those lines. It's said in such a cold way, yet so true. And he doesn't deny it. He fully acknowledges that, you know, yes, of course it's going to have an effect. What a stupid question, you know, but love that as well. So moving on to the direction, then the first note that I have is I absolutely adore the direction of all of the flights in this movie, because I was trying to take notice when I watched it the second time round of what it was that made it feel so immersive to me. And I think it's a combination of like so many things that the director does, and it's things like quick cuts or point of view, or using reflections, putting you into the eyes of the person to see things reflected rather than seeing the whole overall scene. And that might relate to what you were saying, DK, about like having very cramped spaces to film in. So there wasn't a lot of space to do the whole, you know, you're not watching from an omniscient third person view. You're actually right in there with them.
You're there. When they're about to launch, you feel like you're sat on a roller coaster. It's just about to start moving.
Definitely. And related to that, which I'll get into it a bit more later, but related to that, I think whenever it cut out sound completely to emphasize that you were there, because, you know, there wouldn't have been music or background sort of film score or whatever. So whenever they were sitting there tensely waiting for a launch or whatever, Chazelle has the balls, I guess, to think, no, we're just going to sit here with the silence for 10 seconds or whatever, because that's what it would have been. So why sugarcoat it? We're going to go for the reality. And I think that does, it helps to immerse you more, and it really makes you feel way more nervous tension for them as well.
This has made me want to watch more Chazelle films, because I think the direction on this was just beautiful in parts.
Yeah, same. And yet none of us have watched La La Land, which we probably should. Yeah, we should give that one a go for sure. But yeah, I just thought... as I said, we're beating a dead horse, but I've said the same as you, Sandy, have said a few times. Show, don't tell works really well, juxtaposing the sick kid with work and kind of all that kind of thing. Intimate, detailed close-ups to show emotion, because it has to be that focused. The exposition being quite diegetic, because it doesn't take you out of the reality, was something that I noticed, which, you know, it's just basically a very over-the-top, highfalutin way of me saying, instead of like stopping the movie for, and this is what Armstrong and co had to do in that, you know, it's like there'll be a video playing for the astronauts of what they've got to do, or a news report telling you what's going to happen. So it never breaks the reality of the movie for, you are watching a movie, this is what had to happen next. So, which again, you might not think it, but there's a surprising number of movies that wouldn't do that, that would go for that disconnection. So I appreciated that.
Realism, putting me in the seat, that is what stuck out to me most throughout 100%. All of this.
Yeah, and really related to that, this is again a little touch, but I had to make a note of it, is that in one of those scenes when they're kind of tilting the capsule skywards to go for the launch. And it's the littlest thing, but I was like, what a cool directorial touch that to show that they're now facing skyward, because there's no change. It's still just kind of blue sky outside, but it just shows a bird flying
the
past.
Bird flying over, yeah.
I was like, that is such a genius touch because it's so subtle, but it tells you everything you need to about, and now we're pointing directly upwards. So, yeah.
I do think it was a good idea to not increase the capacity, the size of the ship. For filming, obviously, because I mean, they came across as so cramped with the viewport so small. It's a wonder that they managed to get anything done and just did not just go insane. They're practically
blind.
There were
so many times, besides the, like you said, the riding of the ship to point skywards, there were so many times that you were inside that capsule and you could not see anything. You were either listening to the radio chatter, what he was saying, what he was doing, what he was trying next. And they would show you some exterior shots of the ship, but it just gave you this feeling of helplessness in that ship and how dependent they were on their instruments, because you could not just look out the window and see what landmark you're passing.
No. Yeah.
Especially when you hear that, when it starts to creak, the pressure on the outside of the cabin.
Yeah. Oh, definitely.
Scary.
Related to that, then, I was curious to know you guys' thoughts, because obviously mine are quite self-explanatory, but the kind of, I love how stunning the views when they get there of kind of the atmosphere and then the Earth from orbit and everything is, and all the space scenes. And when things are going well, the fact that it does kind of fall back on that cliche, I guess, of classical music, but somehow I don't mind it. And then, as I say, it cuts out as soon as there's a danger or a threat. But I will say the kind of the awe of space, it does take the time to still do that. And it does still hit me as somebody who loves kind of space stuff. And I would assume that would probably be the same for at least one or two of you, one of the two of you as well. So did you get that from the space scenes? Or because, again, it's such an easy thing to take for granted, I suppose. But just the awe of, wow, we're in outer space.
Yeah. And again, it's from Neil's perspective. It's not for the audience to see how awesome space is, but it was Neil's first time in space, or his first time on the moon. What he saw, what he felt. And so you did get those quiet moments where, you know, you would be doing the same thing. You'd be sitting there just like, wow, I'm in space right now.
Exactly. Yeah. 100%. Awesome. And so on a slightly less kind of pleasant side, one of the things that hits me the hardest in this film is the fact that they do actually show the tragedy with Gus Grissom and co, and the kind of the horrible fire that in the training and everything. It really hits me because, again, it doesn't do the gory and grisly kind of thing. It plays it for the tension and it just cuts away from the action or whatever's going wrong. You know, you have all of that frantic kinetic, what's happening? And then it cuts away and you just see the boom and the kind of the pressure bust out the door, I guess.
Yeah.
And then silence. And it's just so like, because you know, this is real people and it really happened to me. It really just genuinely broke my heart for a second. And then to see the effect that it had on Neil, because as we've mentioned, the kind of, he doesn't want to betray emotion or anything. So he gets the phone call and it's just like a completely calm sea, no reaction whatsoever. And then the camera pans down and he smashed his glass with his hand because he's been like, struggling to keep the emotion, I guess, in check. So I think the combination of those two scenes is probably, it feels wrong to say a favorite part of the movie, but certainly most impactful part of the movie for me. And I was wondering if it hit you guys maybe in the same way, or you just thought it was maybe overplayed or a bit.
No, it was done really well, especially as it interspersed with, you know, the hobnobbing and talking to senators about the funding. And
yes,
you had this impending sense of doom. But again, even though you know events, you're kind of going, no, please, no, please, no. So when it does actually happen, you are fully there with him.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. Awesome. And it does seem to be a theme where when he's not betraying the emotion on his face, it's something, you know, he's wringing his hands, talking to his kids. He smashes the glass when he hears this news. So that's interesting.
Definitely. But did you get affected, not to sort of put you on the spot, but did you get affected by the kind of showing of the tragedies and things? Because I was surprised the film took the time to show it in that kind of, not detail, but that kind of an influence rather than just the effect it had on Neil, if it's his story. So I kind of would have expected the film, I guess, to almost just show the phone call. So when it showed it, I think, like I said, it really affected me profoundly knowing it was real. Did it have the same effect on you, Sandy? Or
maybe not as profoundly, but it was tragic, certainly. And
yeah,
and just the in, I felt more like the injustice of it all. Like, where was everybody? And why did this happen? I mean, it was just, it wasn't even like they were prepping for an actual mission. It was just a practice run. And yet this tragedy happened. And then it also raised the stakes of, you know, do these people really know what they're doing?
Yeah. And like I said, the fact that it really emphasizes that the littlest thing can mean disaster. And that's when you get the scenes after that of like seatbelts and flies in the cockpit and stuff. And it's like, we've seen the littlest thing literally cause a disaster. Yeah. That nervous tension is very there after that. So, yeah.
And then immediately after that, they have that conversation where the Kieran Hines, I forget the real guy, and he says, you know, are you ready to pay the cost? And Neil turns around and says, well, it's a little bit late to asking that question, don't you think?
I'll definitely be bringing that up again later. but yeah. And I think the constant kind of when we get to the moon flight as well, and it takes the time to show Neil constantly eyeing up all the different like back out buttons and stuff and ways out, which is something he's never done at any other point, which for me, it shows growth. And it also shows that he's not unaware of the depth or the gravitas of what's going on here, even if he seems very focused. But, you know, related to that, I also love that, again, Giselle was tasked with showing us something that we've seen so many times in that Apollo 11 landing. And the almost balletic take, I guess, of it was something that I really appreciated. And again, the use of like jarring silence as they descend, and the fact that he has the guts to include like the boot print and the iconic imagery and the lines and everything. And it doesn't feel hokey or, yeah, I've seen this part. It just really affects me, at least. Okay. So did you guys, I've kind of talked a lot about direction and sound and music there. Did you guys have any other thoughts or things you wanted to call out about that you thought would be worth mentioning?
Well, the music, again, another thing that was understated, but I thought it was interesting that they used the theremin. I'm actually not even sure if I'm using that correctly. Yeah. And they did that because it was an actual interest of Neil Armstrong's, and it was very haunting in places. And then they did also use when they had launched Apollo 11 and they were talking about music, they used Lunar Rhapsody there, which was also something that Neil Armstrong listened to. So I thought it was cool that they included that just in the vein of being realistic and trying to bring the truth of this man. But there was no sweeping scores or anything like that. And again, it was because, you know, we were supposed to sit with these moments, not feel any forced emotion over these moments. They were emotional enough. And so I just thought it was interesting that, again, the music was kind of understated in this.
Definitely. I mean, Justin Hurwitz's soundtrack, I thought that was absolutely fantastic. My first thought was, I've got to get a copy of that soundtrack. His use of the theremin and the Moog synthesizers, that entire section from where they're descending to the lunar landing right to when they do actually land, I just thought, oh, it was just beautiful.
It is. It's fantastic. Very evocative and very reminiscent of kind of classic 60s and 70s sci-fi for me anyway. I got, maybe it's just me, but I got some kind of old school Doctor Who vibes almost from it in that scene as well. So,
because of the Moog synthesizer, he took me back to Wendy Carlos with the Clockwork Orange.
Okay, fair enough. Cool. Yeah, I didn't know anything about the kind of music and stuff like that, so it was fascinating to hear from you two about that kind of thing. That's awesome.
And did you mention the cinematography here? Did you want to talk about that yet, or is that a different...
I'm definitely going to have, the last thing I have is just scenes and kind of, general things, you know, other things to talk about. But certainly if you want to take the lead on that, then yeah, the cinematography has to be talked about because it's fantastic. Did you have anything else you wanted to add other than that? Or was it just to point out how good it was?
Well, I mean, it's just, I thought it was interesting that they used three different formats. They used the 16 millimeter for some parts, and they used those are for inside the spacecraft, and the 35 millimeter for inside the Armstrong house. And then they actually did use IMAX for the Earth scenes, and just the different effects that had. I noticed some things like some of the footage from them lifting off and stuff was very grainy.
Yeah.
So it did feel like, you know, footage from the actual flight. And I thought that was interesting. And then when they had these moments at home between the family, the way they were filmed, where the family was in light, but everything around was darkness. So it was almost like vignettes. And it just made it very intimate moments for the family.
Awesome. I didn't realize that they'd done that interview, but I think I kind of subconsciously must have done, because I picked up on, like I said, that there were times when it felt almost like a home movie when it was supposed to be showing you the kind of familial and the domestic side of things. And that kind of almost looked like it had, I guess, a sepia or a filter on it to make it look of the time to me anyway, or it seemed like almost a bit washed out. But when you couple that with the fantastic, the awesome like period sets and the fashions and everything, it really did make me feel like I was just watching a slice of life from the 1960s, which again is an easy thing to take for granted, but not necessarily easy. So lighting and cinematography. But then, as you said, I did pick up on the sheer scope and the clarity when you get out into space or you're in the module as well. So that's just awesome work generally, I think, all around.
They did purposely do that. They built exact models. I think there was only one module that they did have to enlarge a little bit, but in most cases they did stick to that realism religiously. Ryan Gosling and Chazelle even went and visited museums together. That attention to detail is just so important for what they were trying to do.
Definitely, 100%. And the last note that I have is just something that my kind of film student-y brain picked up on, which was, I thought it was quite telling that the movie doesn't end with the victory of the moon landing. It actually ends with the victory of him reconnecting even through glass with his wife, which again reaffirms that it's not about the mission. It's a story about the man who went on that mission. And now he's back to Earth, and in spite of everything, he can reconnect because he's achieved his goals. And even though, as you said, a lot of people that went through that have felt disconnected, I think it probably, the impression I got was that it probably brought him closer to his wife, I guess, in a way, because he was able to achieve what he wanted, and he was able to, I guess, let go of his grief up there in some way, maybe even.
In this two-hour and 12-minute movie, the moon landing was just the last 20 minutes, and it was just 10 minutes of the film.
Yeah, exactly. So, which isn't to say it isn't done fantastically well, and given that gravitas. So, you guys happy to move on to our favorite character moment and line before we get the audience interaction?
Sure.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, we'll go around the corner. We'll start with the guest, and then we'll hit you, DK, and then me, and we'll do it one at a time. And we'll start with perhaps a silly question, but who was your favorite character in the movie? Sandy, we'll start with you.
Right. It is difficult because it is just Neil Armstrong, and it'd be silly to say he wasn't my favorite character.
Yeah.
Truly. But I mean, Buzz certainly had his moments, and the people in flight control, they had their moments when they would have relief and they were there joking and bantering, maybe making some off-color jokes there amongst themselves. But it really was just about Neil. So I would have to say he was my favorite character.
Fair enough. And what about you, DK?
I'm going to have to be slightly controversial here and say I don't have a favorite character. Simply because
I always associate.
Well, I'm hoping we can. It's the first time I've done it.
No.
Because I always associate your favorite character with something that is incredible, you know, a film that's written on a character that's created. I couldn't really, to me, it would be doing a disservice to these real life people to pick a favorite.
Now we look like jerks.
No, it's just a personal perspective. I mean, obviously, you know, my first choice would be Neil, say, but he's the star of the show. But I think it does a, in my opinion, I mean, you know, it just does a disservice to these real life people. I think I would take that stand with any biopic as such.
Yeah, fair enough. I understand where you're coming from, but I was with Sandra. I just said, obviously, it's going to be Neil Armstrong. But for me, I think the fact that it was a three-dimensional portrayal actually helped that rather than hindered it. So I found there was a lot more to connect with rather than, like, this isn't a fluff piece, for example.
Yeah.
I appreciated that. And that's what made it more of an enjoyable experience, getting to know that person although it is a real person rather than fictional. So, yeah, fair enough. So what's your favorite moment or scene in the film then, Sandra?
My favorite moment or scene is something that you guys had touched on. It's when he's walking down that retractable bridge to Gemini 8. And you see the fluorescent light fixtures are swaying. The whole bridge quakes, and you see the Agena rocket go up in the background, and it's just so real. That's what prepped me for, you know, when they went into the takeoff of Gemini, and it sounds so scary. It's so scary and loud. And just when you think it can't sound any scarier, it sounds scarier still. Just the intensity of that whole thing, the realism. I felt like I was there. And that really has to be my favorite scene.
Definitely. The impact of the kind of the, I guess, noise and violent rush and everything in such a quiet movie is very deliberate. And I've really felt that as well. As soon as it got loud, it was like, oh, okay. Yeah. I'm on edge here. So, yeah, totally appreciated that as well. DK, what about you?
It's exactly the same as Sandra, that whole Gemini takeoff scene. I just think it's done masterfully.
That's fair enough. I'll be the one that differs here then and say that despite what you might think to the contrary, my favorite moment is actually the scene when they're spinning out and the Earth is like rotating and appearing in front of the window in a weird kind of because for me, it was really emotionally gripping, immersive cinema. Like, fair enough, it made me have to step outside and almost be sick. But at the same time, that would have been a fraction of what the actual real life people were going through. And I appreciated the filmmaker, you know, forcing me to feel that, I guess. Otherwise, yeah. I'm a little bit masochistic. Yeah. So, yeah.
That was one of those parts, too, where when they would flash back to Neil's face, it looked a little grainy. And so that you almost did feel like you were losing consciousness, like you were gripping on the consciousness in that point. So, yeah, that was well done.
Definitely, definitely. And finally, what was your favorite line of dialogue in the movie then, Sandy?
Well, I mean, there were actually two, and again, with the whole understated thing, I mean, there wasn't a lot of flashy dialogue. So one that you had mentioned before, you know, when they're sitting there, they're talking about who's going to actually land the lunar module. And Buzz says, well, you know, it's been up for grabs since Gus died. And everybody looks at him. He's like, well, I'm just saying what you're thinking. And Neil says, well, maybe you shouldn't. And, you know, that actually made me ha-ha, you know, out loud. I thought that was kind of funny. But, yeah. I mean, outside of that, it would have to go to Claire Foy. Like when she goes up, you know, her speaker's been turned off. She runs up there. Mm-hmm. And she really says something out loud that I think the direction the film was trying to make you see. She says all these protocols and procedures to make it seem like you have it under control, but you're a bunch of boys making models out of fossil wood. You don't have anything under control. And we did get that sense, you know, when the pressure's building inside the capsule and everything's creaking and just how much was left up to pen and paper, how there's an alarm going off and they're saying, yep, don't worry about that alarm. Same alarm. Don't worry about that alarm. I mean, it just really was... everything was new, stepping onto the moon. He didn't know if he was going to sink into quicksand. I mean, they just didn't know anything. They were taking a lot on faith. And I thought that kind of encapsulated that.
Awesome. Definitely. That was an awesome sort of version of putting us into that perspective that the film, you know, could have done more of perhaps, but I appreciated what did happen. And it feels wrong to call it the feminist perspective, but, you know, in terms of 1960s dynamics, it was kind of the wives' perspective, I suppose, on what the, I see it was very boys playing with toys as far as they were concerned. Thankfully, NASA, not so much of a boys club now, but at the time, unfortunately, it probably was. So,
right.
Yeah, awesome. What about you, DK?
Well, this probably plays into my predilection for the subject of our other podcast, but my favourite line is the one at the start where they're judging his compatibility for the mission. Mm. And he says, I don't know what I don't know what space exploration will uncover, but I don't think it'll be exploration just for the sake of exploration. I think it'll be more the fact that it allows us to see things that maybe we should have seen a long time ago, but just haven't been able to until now.
Yeah, I forgot that line. Good. That is really powerful, actually. Yeah. And very Star Trek. You're not wrong. Awesome. Yeah, cool. My favorite line, as I say, I've already kind of basically alluded to it, and we've mentioned it a few times, but it's when they're kind of talking about, you know, Neil doing these tests and how they're nervous about it. And he just says, we need to fail down here so we don't fail up there. And his superior says, at what cost? To which he just replies with such emotion, it's a little bit late for that question, isn't it, sir? Which, yeah, again, just brought tears to my eyes, because perhaps because of coupled with the impact of the scene of the kind of actual loss of life and stuff, I was like, oof, that hits me like a sledgehammer. So I appreciated that dialogue a lot to kind of spell that out for me, I guess, as well. So yeah,
true, awesome. True. Like, we've already paid for it. Now we need to reap those benefits.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. It's a bit late to consider it now. You probably should have done before, kind of thing. So, yeah, fair enough. Well, if there's nothing else for that, then I'm going to jump us into the next section before we give our conclusion. And that's going to be the audience interaction, to get the audience's opinions on this movie. We did put out the usual kind of social media on like Twitter and Facebook and the like. And I also posted to a Discord film server that I'm in. I'm going to start with from Twitter. A familiar face, at @Will_Templar. Even when he's not on the episodes, he has to contribute. but no, I do know this is one of his favorite movies as well. He just says, all I can really remember is the exhilarating soundtrack that Mike probably didn't even notice. Yes, he has a thing about me not noticing soundtracks because they kind of wash over me. I owe it another rewatch because I loved it. My granddad in particular loved it. We both found the ending with what I recall being the child's necklace to be really touching. I then responded, I noticed the powerful decision to have a lack of soundtrack at key moments. Otherwise, I was focused on the stunning visuals. You're right about the necklace, but I think it was a bracelet, by the way. And then Will said, especially at the moment when the kid passed and he locked himself in his room and cried, the lack of music then was phenomenal. And then he chimed back in and just said, that being said, I want to really point out that this is my second favorite piece of music from any film I've ever seen. And he's posted a link to The Landing from First Man by Justin Hurwitz on YouTube.
Yeah. I agree with you there, Will. Nice one.
Awesome. I'm assuming his first piece of music was probably from Interstellar, because I know he loves that movie. So yeah. At @MarioBowser494 on the contrary says, it was good but not really for me. The ending was phenomenal though, and my cousin who loves all things space loved it. So yeah. And then, as I say, in my Discord group, I just asked, what were your thoughts on the film we're reviewing, First Man? Bo Burn Him Alive says, met, not enough space, too much Neil Armstrong being a boring man. Wumbo on the same forum took a little bit of offense to this and said, you go to space then if it's so dang easy. Every man who does it is boring. You sicken me. So, <yeah. laughs> Jack T said, I prefer the sequel Second Man. Hilarious. Funky _Player2 says, I thought it was dumb because there were many men who existed before Ryan Gosling did. that just got me. It's a terrible joke, I'm sorry, but yeah, not the first man at all. Let's see, where were we? And then I do have, I think, Mystery Angel says, yes, I saw the movie in theaters, thought it was boring, the ending was cool, but that's it. So yeah, a bit of a detractor, I think, from that one.
And it's not for everyone, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. I can kind of understand, because like I said, the film has the bravery to kind of let you sit in these moments and cut out the sound and let you sit there. But I suppose if you have no attention span, maybe it's going to bug you. But so yeah, that was all I had for audience response. But I think you said you had at least one DK from some of your friends.
I have, yeah. I posted in a cinema group on Facebook. So it's a shout out to Screen Talk, and it's the guy that runs it, which is Dave Trotter. And this was a comment from Dennis O'Carroll. He says, I watched it last year. Not a bad film at all. Gosling does a good job as Neil Armstrong. And even though we know the outcome, the moments leading up to the Eagle landing on the moon are still tense enough. Personally, though, I would love to see Kirk Lazarus's version, Moonshot, where he went so method he was found in a box in an alleyway thinking he was in the lunar module attempting re-entry. I have no idea what that is, but
I'm fascinated.
I think that's a bit more than method acting there.
Yeah.
Wow. I'm intrigued. I'm going to look that up now as well.
Yeah.
Awesome. Fascinating.
You know, this film actually did win an Oscar, Best Achievement in Visual Effects.
That's good.
Oh, well deserved.
Definitely, yeah. I thought it might have gotten some more, but I think that was because La La Land had gotten like multiple nominations before. But then, like I said, I realized when I was watching it, the performances weren't really that showy, flashy, we can show this scene during your consideration speech kind of thing. So It's not necessarily the kind of film that would win awards, but it's definitely one I would recommend seeing. We're going to move on then to just giving our conclusions and scores. And I'm going to do it a little bit differently because I'm going to give mine first because it's going to surprise nobody. And I'm curious to see what our guest Sander is after that. And then what your thoughts finally are, DK, as somebody who's just come into this for the podcast. So I'm going to start us off and I'll just say, this is a bit like a film designed by committee to appeal to me. I'm a massive space nerd, surprising nobody, endlessly fascinated with that great frontier, NASA, and the brave men and women who go there. I'm also a bit of a modern history buff with a love of biopics and docudrama that's done well to depict events not that removed from us in time. And finally, I'm a lover of great cinema and the artistry behind it. From the central performance to the many touches of directorial genius to the story being told and the execution of every job by all involved, it just hits for me. I know enough to know the parts that are historically accurate, and I appreciate the dramatization of those, but also the drama of the bits that may not be truthful or that we can't exactly know. There's nothing that seems egregiously wrong, and so this film feels like it perfectly places me in that crucial historical time and the life of the man who went down in history. Any complaints I could make are just minor niggles, and yet there's so much that captivates, soars, and is beautifully presented. Immersive, brilliant cinema that is truly out of this world. And again, surprising nobody, I gave it 5 stars out of 5, which, ooh, the shock. So that was my thoughts on the film. Sandra, as our guest, I would normally have went to you first, but I'm intrigued to know what your thoughts are on the movie.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm a little bit more critical. You know, I judge a film on if it evokes, you know, some emotion from me. And it certainly did because I was scared, you know, in some parts. But I really don't think, and this does sound absurd, but I really don't think they were asking us to love their movie even. They wanted us to walk away, you know, loving the man and what he did and the sacrifices. And I do think it achieved that separate from the film. So, yeah, I went with a
4.2. 4.2, very specific. Awesome. Yeah. The first person that hasn't just given us a solid number. Oh, I like it.
I just can't.
And DK, what about you?
Okay, it's my usual long, rambling conclusion, so bear with me.
It's always mine, don't worry about it.
Okay, First Man is a fascinating look into the life of one of the most famous yet enigmatic people in modern history. Armstrong was always a very private person, which over the years has seen him as both a legend, icon, and at the same time, someone that I would hazard a guess as to say the majority knows very little about past the headlines. He was a true pioneer, and yet he's almost treated as a footnote despite his achievements, such as our preoccupation with celebrity. This gave us a look into Armstrong as a living, breathing individual, and balanced the usual right stuff type scenes one would expect from a film of this type, with glimpses into his family and home life. This could have been an exercise in navel-gazing in the hands of some, but screenwriter Josh Singer, director Damien Chazelle, and its two leads, Ryan Gosling and Claire Foy, all craft such a moving experience that any dull moments are few and far between. Though if I had one minor criticism, it would be that personally, some of the scenes broke up the story, while some scenes seem to be cut far too short. It humanises Armstrong in a way that takes us past the glory, past the usual televised highlights, and shows us just how dedicated and human he was. The effects are incredibly believable. The attention to detail seems, to a layman at least, second to none, and it demonstrates just how much care went into the production. The supporting cast do their jobs well, even when one or two accents slip a little, and the entire thing is an exercise in how to tell a story well. It may not have the gloss or polish of movies like Apollo 13, but First Man is a fascinating and deep dive into a modern-day hero, and I was gripped, and I've given it 4.5 out of 5.
Okay, fair enough. So, if I'm not mistaken then, so that gives us a total overall for the podcast of 4.56666 out of 5. So, for argument's sake, we'll just call that a 4.5 out of 5, which is still a very, very exceptional score, in my opinion, an exceptional movie. So,
you know, speaking of footnote, we didn't mention Michael Collins, not even once.
I know, right? No. What guy?
Yeah, and I couldn't believe it was Lucas Haas.
Right, yeah. Yeah, that's great. Excellent. It seems like a very good episode. I'm happy with the way that went. And Sandra, thanks for joining us and being a fantastic guest. That was awesome.
I'd love to do it again sometime, if possible.
Yeah, well, thank you for that.
We'd love to have you back on another time.
Definitely.
fantastic. And you definitely know your stuff, and you watched and enjoyed the movie and took your notes, I think. So that's awesome. So where can people find you then, Sandra, if they wanted to find you to talk about movies or anything in general?
Oh, just... I don't even remember my Twitter handle right now. I think it's Evanson Sandra at Twitter, and that's pretty much all I'm on.
But I do love to talk about movies.
I love stories in general so much, and of course, movies being the most immersive medium for that. I just really love movies, all kinds.
That's awesome. Well, I think you're following our podcast channels and stuff. So, as I say, if you don't mind me doing it, I'll post a link to your Twitter in the description and everything. So that'll be great. And yeah, if anybody wants to talk movies with any of us, you know the rest of the details. I am at Iron Mike Wilson on Twitter, or my name everywhere else. The podcast is podcast_screen on Twitter, or Silver Screen Podcast, or the audio feed is under Mike's podcast feed. And yeah, DK, did you want to shout out your deets?
It's usually listed under the podcast. It's at AKA Star-Lord. My articles can also be found on Warp Factor Trek and CultureSlate.com.
Fantastic. And you can still check out all of our work on the Hit or Miss Star Trek podcast, which is also always linked around below, or it's at HOMTrek on Twitter, which links you to everywhere. We'll be back with that soon, but we're focusing on movies for the time being. And speaking of which, we will be back next week with a timely-ish movie review. I'm going to be joined by DK as usual, and by George and Connor from Pasty Sheep. And we're going to be looking at What We Do in the Shadows, the original docudrama movie version of that. So I'm looking forward to that one as we await Taika Waititi's next newest movie, the new Thor movie. So yeah, join us for that one.
I'd also like to say, if anybody's got any thoughts about this episode, please get in touch and let us know what you think.
Yes, we're struggling a little for audience interaction. So if you have any thoughts about any of the movies we've discussed at any point, but especially during series two, feel free to get in touch in any means, comments or our social medias or email, which you can find listed on social media or below. Hopefully you'll all have enjoyed this episode and you'll join us next week. Thanks again, DK, for joining me as always. And thank you so much, Sandra, for being an awesome first-time guest. Yeah, that's great. So join us again next time. And always remember, in the epic words of Arnie, I'll be back.
I'm gonna step off the limb now. It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.